Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you were just listening to En Vogue. You're never going to get it back, because today is Maxine Jones's birthday, one of the singers of En Vogue, born in 1962. We are about to turn our attention again to some other issues facing this nation with our two guests. We are joined here by Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and yesmagazine.org. And Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor at The Root, contributor to Al Jazeera America, and a columnist and political analyst appearing on MSNBC, ABC, CBS Washington, and nationally syndicated radio. And welcome, Sarah and Edward. Good to have you both back with us here.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And that'll be 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also log on to our Facebook pages and to comment and tweet us at Mark Steiner. Let me say on our way there, because I forgot to do this at the top of the hour, that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's Maryland, one word, marylandeducators.org, or log on to steinershow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association banner. All the information is there as well. Let me begin, Edward, just with a piece you just wrote on these promise zones that have been covered a little bit in the press that I've seen that President Barack Obama talked about in the wake of the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty, and he picked some of the similar locations: Philadelphia, Los Angeles, San Antonio, Appalachian Mountains, native areas in Oklahoma. But I get your sense of this. I want Sarah to comment on this as well. And before I throw in my little editorial comment, go ahead.
just to break it down, basically, the president realizes that it's very difficult to get anything through this House of Representatives, this Republican-led House of Representatives, and that certainly won't change any time between now and November, if people actually come out and vote and change the balance of power in the Congress. And so one of the things that he had been pushing for, I think, about a year and a half, was the American Jobs Act, which was going to create investments in failing communities. It was also going to spark infrastructure spending and therefore create jobs. It was going to do things like extend unemployment insurance for the long-term unemployed. And I think the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, said that had that been passed, 2 million jobs would have been added to the U.S. economy. And I think President Obama realized after a while that just this was a stalled Congress. They were playing politics of obstruction, and so has found and maneuvered ways to do these kinds of investments through executive action and also taking advantage of existing programs that are funded through discretionary spending. And so there are going to be 20 promise zones in total, but these are the first five. And one of the key strategies of the White House has been to focus not just on the stereotypical idea of urban poverty, particularly black and brown poverty in urban areas, but to be more expansive and to focus on rural poverty, which is largely white in this country, which is why you see investments in places like the Appalachian Mountains in Kentucky, but also Native American poverty, which is what I called in the article the invisible poor. I think I did some research where I showed that 93% of some Native American populations are unemployed. This is a generational problem. And so I think the first five were Philadelphia, the inner city of Philadelphia, San Diego, which has seen a massive decline in its middle class, and really high unemployment in its middle class, not just the lower middle classes and the poor. Los Angeles with a very, very large Hispanic population, also, you know, writhing with the same kind of issues that any inner city would writhe with. And so the president is focusing on these areas. These areas are coming up with solutions in their own communities that are now being funded by federal dollars. And basically, the idea is to invest long-term in these communities. This is not anything that's going to happen overnight, but the idea is to offer better solutions for kids in schools, better programs for kids in schools, but also skills programs for adults seeking employment who either have been long-term unemployed for a long time and now need new skills in order to find jobs. It's very much, I think, a part of what we thought about this president to begin with, that he's about community organizing. He's focused on local communities and people, meeting people where they are. And I just think it's an inspirational program. It needs bigger funding. It needs more attention. But it's a great start, particularly in the age of obstruction that we see with this Republican Party.
And I wonder, when you look at the issues of poverty and people struggling around the country, Sarah Van Gelder, how you'd respond to that?
You know, I just saw this program for the first time yesterday, so I'm still trying to wrap my mind around exactly what it's doing and what it's going to achieve. One thing I'm concerned about is the tax cuts that President Obama is proposing. You know, we've just seen out here in Seattle this race for different states to attract the jobs of the Boeing Corporation through this sort of race to the bottom, everybody trying to cut taxes more than everybody else. And that really leads to disastrous consequences when you don't have enough tax revenue then to fund education and to fund the other things that we need as a society. So if President Obama is proposing that we cut taxes in these particular zones, where are they going to get their tax revenue, and are they going to be feeding that kind of a race to the bottom? So I'm concerned about that. A lot of the other provisions look like they may have some promise. I just haven't had a chance to really delve into them in a lot of detail. But I'm also concerned about the educational provisions, because as much as I think it's really important that we be investing in education, the approach that Obama has taken, this race to the top approach, has been way too much like President Bush's No Child Left Behind. It's way too much focused on high-stakes testing, on, you know, actually punishing schools that are struggling the most instead of supporting them. So I'm really concerned that this is just another way of repackaging some of that same kind of policy, which I believe has failed.
I remember, just to cut on the subject for a couple more minutes, I remember, Edward, when the enterprise zones were created, which were very similar to these to these zones, they were a failure for the most part. I mean, they ended up, most cities ending up profiting people who use those kind of tax credits to build companies for themselves, and the people didn't profit very much from them. You know, and they became, and those areas are still dead zones. I mean, I wonder if this is
a rehashing of old ideas.
Yeah.
You know, I take your point, Mark, and I can't necessarily argue it. I don't have the facts about the enterprise zones in front of me, but I think I made a point in the article to talk about Newark, which is, you know, where I was born and grew up. And I think Newark definitely got some enterprise zone funds that seemingly went nowhere, you know. And I even make the point that Newark, for a long time, because it was getting these funds and they were apparently being directed in the right places to create jobs and opportunities for people, called itself the Renaissance City, and years later still had these abandoned buildings with the Renaissance Zone or Renaissance label on it. It's all very sad. I definitely think that a part of what's happening here for this particular president, to be fair to him, is that he has very limited options to work with. And so I think both you and Sarah make a great point. I think particularly around the tax cuts for these corporations that then don't reinvest in the communities in which they are actually making their profits. But I do think, given the limited options he has, he's doing his best. That said, I'm not quite sure what the long-term results of these programs will be. And that just goes to show how we do live in a democracy where there are three branches of government, and we actually do need Congress to work with president in order to create results and deliver on behalf of their constituents. And without that, you end up having lackluster programs that are halfway implemented, that are underfunded, and that is exactly what we're dealing with.
You know, when you talk about that, and what you're alluding to also in this, Edward, is this divide in America. And one of the things that I've been following very closely taking place in the South now, in North Carolina, South Carolina, and now Georgia, on Moral Mondays, and what are they called in South Carolina? They're called, why am I blocking them? I'll find that in 2 seconds. But that there's this move from the bottom up to kind of...
the populism.
And I wonder what your analysis is of groups like that. Because these are, when you look in the South right now, these are kind of interracial groups led in some ways by the leadership of the NAACP, but all kinds of people gathering on the steps of these capitals, whether it's about Medicare, women's right to choose, economic equality. Sarah, I think that this is a bubbling that I think that we need to pay attention to. Sarah?
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. And it's now moving from North Carolina into Georgia, into South Carolina. I think what a lot of these states are seeing is that the state legislatures have gone completely berserko in the right-wing agenda, and the people are just, instead of just standing by and letting that happen, they're starting to say, you know what, we have got to stop this. We've got to have, you know, the offer that the federal government has made to extend Medicaid to our poor, we need that here in our state. And, you know, these folks are going into the state capitol, and some of them are getting arrested, and they're coming back day after day after day. And I agree with you. I think it's quite moving.
And I mean, Edward, I think it signals kind of a movement in opposition in places like South Carolina and North Carolina, which still is a tipping point state, one of those places we like to call in the political world purple, whatever that means. And Georgia. I mean, I think this is fairly significant.
It is significant. And I think Sarah actually did a really good job of articulating this in Yes Magazine. I read her article. And also went through the magazine online and was really impressed, I have to say, Sarah. Talking about the middle and lower classes fighting for economic justice. And I think, Mark, you and I touched on this, and Sarah touched on this a bit as well with respect to Pope Francis, who I said is occupying the church in the same way Barack Obama is trying to occupy America and Bill de Blasio is trying to occupy New York, is that they are tapping into an energy that I think almost from a historical standpoint, we probably haven't seen since the French Revolution. Ultimately, you have this top 1% that's so out of touch with the malaise that the lower classes are dealing with, the struggles. People are working 2 and 3 jobs and still can't make ends meet. There's no excuse for that in the world's richest democracy. And I think, of course, you are then going to see an uprising of the lower and middle classes, and it's going to start to change policy. It's certainly already affected the debate. The debate is shifting in a different direction, and that's a great, great thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, I just read in the New York Times that now a person working full-time at minimum wage can't afford an apartment, a medium-priced one-bedroom apartment anywhere in the United States. I mean, it's just astounding that, you know, that all the rhetoric is about, you know, go out and find work, and yet the jobs that are out there can't pay enough to where you can afford a place to live.
So exactly.
I think people are kind of coming to terms with that, and that, you know, the American people, 2 to 1, believe that the minimum wage should be higher. So it's going to be interesting to see if the president's going to be able to get some motion out of Congress on that count. And while we're talking about Congress, the Progressive Caucus, we often lose track of these folks. There's this really amazing group in Congress called the Progressive Caucus. And they've got some ideas that are really outstanding ideas. And I think they're worth raising up, even if we don't think, you know, Boehner is going to allow these things to come to the floor. But one of them is to top off the highest tax rate at 49%. Because if we're really serious about income inequality, and that's what part of what it's going to take to get our country to operate right again, is to mm-hmm. raise the taxes on the 1%, as well as to bring the people up from the bottom with a higher minimum wage.
I completely agree, and I want to make a point about something that she just said, because one of the things that I have done research on is this idea that Lord, I'm losing it. I'm losing my thought.
Just take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. All right.
Yeah, take a deep breath. Oh, God. Okay, go ahead, Mark. I actually lost the thought.
Okay,
it'll come back to me.
I know it will. I know, and you just interrupt me when it does. So I mean, I think that what we're talking about now is...
Oh, Mark, I got it. Inflation. This is the thing.
Go.
This is my point about why we have to raise the minimum wage that Sarah just touched on, one of the things that the government has been skillful in doing is convincing Americans that the cost of living has not increased exponentially, and that's because of the way that they report them in the inflation rate, which they basically have just kept it. The Fed has kept it officially at 2%, even though it's more like Argentina in the 1980s and 90s. The inflation rate does not include things like gas or food. How can you not include the price of food or gasoline in the inflation rate? And to that end, people are working these minimum wage jobs, and seemingly things are just getting more expensive, but no one is talking about it. And people in the Progressive Caucus, like she just said, that's how I was tying it together, that's why I lost the thought. The people in the Progressive Caucus talk about these things, but they're hardly ever given a platform, not even on the seemingly progressive MSNBC. They're silent, and the debate in this country, the political debate, is so dominated by the Republican Party that now both Obama and the Progressive Caucus, or the Democratic Caucus in general, have had to move further to the right in order to find any sort of balance in the conversation. That's a really problematic thing when you see what we're seeing, which is this widening gap between the rich and the poor, but also a devastation of the middle class.
And again, about the Progressive Caucus, people really don't know about that, Sarah. I mean, I know that there are members in your state, in Washington State, are part of the Progressive Caucus. There are two members of the Progressive Caucus in Maryland, and there are people who are close to it in Maryland but not members of it. It's the largest single caucus in the U.S. Congress, but it doesn't get a lot of airplay, nor do their ideas.
That's right. It's really not a liberal media at all. I mean, so many times the discussion is between the right and the ultra-right instead of bringing in positions that ordinary Americans are quite comfortable with. And an example of that is single-payer health care. You know, single-payer health care, at least before, they haven't been polling on it lately, but before the Obamacare policy sort of took all the airtime, that was favored by a majority of Americans. If you ask them if they wanted a system like Canada with, you know, the government picking up the cost of insurance, but you still get to pick your own doctor and own hospital, the majority of Americans liked that idea and understood that they were going to pay taxes to make that happen. So there's all sorts of policy ideas out there that Americans favor and yet don't get on the table, and I think the media has some responsibility for that.
Yeah, they do.
No, I think we do, and I think that these things do not get on most airwaves, and nor does a discussion happen where, as we did here earlier in the week, where you put people who are liberal and moderate with conservatives, with people on the left together, as really three different sets of ideas, and let
and
people hear that. We don't get that because everything is kind of glommed into one giant piece, and I think that occurs. All the time. And I think that, you know, I was thinking about some of the things that you have been writing about, Sarah, in your last piece for Yes Magazine. And again, you know, there's got to be, these things get lost. I mean, the reason I started with Moral Mondays and still can't remember the name of the thing in South Carolina, which is Something Tuesday, Dangerous Tuesday, Something Tuesdays, it'll come to me in a minute, it's a T. But is that these things are happening all across America. Whether it is Native Americans and the environment and economic rights, or people rising up across country fighting for the minimum wage, Truthful Tuesdays.
Truthful Tuesdays.
That's in South Carolina.
I just Googled it. I just Googled it.
And so did we. That's what we
found. Because I was like, he is not going to let this go. Let's give him the title. It was like me with my inflation boy. I'm like, I'm going to get my inflation
boy. So, like, what do we do before this existed? I don't know. But I think that's part of what's missing here is people do feel disconnected.
Yeah.
We're very isolated, despite the internet pulling us all together on some levels, being threatened now, as we talked about earlier in this program, about net neutrality could be is one of the battles of the moment people aren't paying attention to coming out of the FCC and federal court. But despite this kind of communications we have, people are feeling very isolated in this country in terms of what they're standing up for.
I think Sarah, please go ahead. You go first.
Okay. So, yeah, I think that's right. I think people do feel really isolated. They feel, you know, they may want to be throwing their shoes at the television, but that's not really going to do the trick. And I think there's two things that are really important there. One is for people to get out and meet their neighbors and get involved in the local issues that move them. Because once people get together, even if it's only three people over coffee who say, you know what, we're not going to take this anymore, that becomes the seed for a movement, and that really makes a difference. And especially when you do that locally, you have the kind of clout that you know sometimes gets lost when we try to operate nationally. Although I don't want to give up that territory either. And then the second thing is to connect nationally with the other people who are feeling the same thing you're feeling. So when you have that local base and that local community, and you guys, you're out there supporting one another, but then you find out who else is operating nationally and don't depend on the media, except for a few folks like Mark and like Yes Magazine, you know, they won't get covered necessarily. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that there aren't things happening that are really exciting.
Go ahead. Edward, go ahead. You're about to say something?
Well, I literally just agree. I think that there's also something, and I hate to say this, I think there's something a bit, not sinister, but there's something almost, there's something in our society where even when there are uprisings, so like we saw the Occupy movement here in New York, all across the country, really, but in New York, the crackdown on the Occupy movement, also in Washington, D.C., I have to say, because at that time last year, during the 2012 campaign, I was going back and forth between Washington and New York a lot for work. And the crackdown, not just from police, but also the rhetoric from the surrounding communities, people who understood the ideologies and platform that people in the Occupy movement were trying to promote, but also felt like, oh, we don't want them in the streets. Oh, they're sleeping in the park. Oh, what are they doing? I wasn't alive in the 60s, but I get the sense that when there was this sort of political uprising around poverty, around minimum wage, around jobs and freedom and civil rights, that you did not have the very people who needed those movements speaking against them. And I feel like Americans, they bought into the lie that they're all going to turn around and be rich tomorrow and everybody's going to live some Kim Kardashian life. And they don't understand that in order to create change, you've got to get into the fight. You have got to get involved and you've got to work with those who are committed to it. And I don't see that. And I think that's what's, and back to the point that we were making, I think, last week, Mark, and that Sarah made in her article about the Pope, I think that that's what was so special about him, is that you have this man in such a position of privilege where he could literally stay silent, and he's speaking to the core issues of the people who would go out and actually and fight and promote and talk about these things. And I think that's what we need more in this country. You literally have people at the bottom who are acquiescing, and that's what's really messed up about all of this.
And the final thoughts, Sarah, from you, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a friend of mine used to be, back in the day, was a person who did some of the organizing when Dr. King wanted to speak. And what he found was that it was actually very difficult, even among the communities, even in the black church, for him to find places that would allow him to speak because people were scared. So I think there's actually a long history of the people who you would expect to jump on board not jumping on board right away, that a lot of change happens because a relatively small group of people just have the courage, like these Moral Mondays and Truthful Tuesdays are showing us, to step out. So on that count, I think, you know, I think we just have to understand that we have to just be out there working, because a small percentage of the people really do make the change. And the second thing is, you know, in terms of where the middle class is, you know, I think there was a time when not too long ago, when a lot of people did think they were, if they weren't wealthy now, it's just temporary. They were going to be those Kim Kardashians, you know, just in the near future. But I think actually the last 5 years, this recession has has turned a lot of people around, and I think there's now much more understanding that most of us are on the brink of poverty if we're not already there. We're just a few paychecks away, or one serious illness, even with Obamacare, away from potentially being on the street. So I think we have a different potential now for a mass movement than we might have a few years ago, when the middle class really thought that corporate America was going to take care of them.
Well, it's always great to have the two of you on, and I appreciate you taking the time again with all of our listeners. Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and yesmagazine.org. Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor to The Root and contributor to Al Jazeera America, also a columnist and political analyst who appears widely on MSNBC, ABC, CBS, Washington, and nationally syndicated radio. Good to have you both with us once again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And reminding you, this Saturday, please join me January the 18th at 5 p.m. I'm moderating one of Everyman Theater's World of the Play panels for their current performance of Crimes in Their Heart. I'll be talking with Teresa Eyring of New York's Theater Communications Group, TCG, major theater group in the country, D.C. playwright and dramaturg Jacqueline Lawton, and Jackson Breyer, professor emeritus of American theater at the University of Maryland College Park. We're going to be talking about how women's voices in the theater reflect our culture. And it's a really important conversation. Don't want you to miss it. Please go to everyman.org to get your tickets and come join us as we explore how women's voices in the theater reflect our culture. Stay with us. We'll be right back. When we come back, it's Craig Stephenweiler, Ebony and Ivy, and we are going out now with Charlie Brown by the Coasters, because on this day in 2000, we lost Dub Jones, one of the Coasters.